My name is Crystal Donnelly. I'm the Deputy Head of Department at the Oxford Department of Statistics, and I'm delighted to welcome you today for our Florence Nightingale Bicentenary Lecture. This was an event that was originally scheduled for the 18th of March, but it was not able to go ahead because of COVID and control measures and required social distancing to keep us all safe. But we're really pleased to be able to welcome you still within 2020. So we're still respecting the bicentenary nature of this lecture. The planning for this event began over 5 years ago, and we're extremely grateful to David Green, who's the director of the Florence Nightingale Museum, for bringing people together, setting up a Florence Nightingale 2020 planning committee, and bringing together a wide range of professions. And that was from both the UK and beyond, so we could really leave a legacy of this and help people understand Florence Nightingale and what she stood for. Please do take the opportunity to visit the virtual exhibition that we've compiled. That includes you being able to view some original correspondence between Florence Nightingale and Benjamin Jowett, who was at the time warden of Balliol College. You can find out about some modern Nightingales and also learn more about the Florence Nightingale Museum and its work. The link will be published on a slide during the break, which, as you can see on the schedule here, is between 4 and 4:15. I'd like to thank Liam individually, but the ICMS more generally for hosting this event and more widely for supporting mathematical sciences through what has been a very difficult time for all of us. We also thank XTX Markets, who generously have sponsored this event and more generally this annual lecture series. So they've been supportive over a long time period and specifically gave us additional funding to support the creation of this bicentenary commemorative program that hopefully many of you have received. Finally, we'd like to give thanks to the RSS, the Royal Statistical Society, for their help and support in planning this event. Now, hundreds of you are joining us today from around the world. And those come from a range of disciplines, including medical research and nursing, but in areas as well as government and education, and those with just a general interest in Florence Nightingale and the history of science. It is my great pleasure to welcome our speaker and my colleague, Professor Deborah Ashby. She is director of the School of Public Health at Imperial College London, where she holds the chair in medical statistics and clinical trials. She was a founding co-director of the Imperial College Trials Unit. She is a chartered statistician, and her interests are in clinical trials, risk-benefit decision-making for medicines, and the utility of Bayesian approaches in these areas. She has sat on the UK Commission on Human Medicines, and she acts as an advisor to the European Medicines Agency. She was awarded an OBE for services to medicine in 2009. She was appointed as an NIHR senior investigator in 2010 and was elected as a fellow of the Academy of Medical Sciences in 2012. She is currently the president of the Royal Statistical Society, and this will probably be one of her last events in that capacity. So we're very honored to hear from her. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Crystal. So I just need to share my screen. Right, is that sharing properly?
Yes.
Brilliant. So thank you so much for the invitation. It was one of the most advanced invitations I got. I think it was more than a year and a half in advance of when this was originally meant to be. And thank you so much for reconvening it in Florence's bicentenary year. So we're going to talk about Florence Nightingale. She was born in, if you're good at sums, you'll realize she was born in 1820. And she was born in the city of Florence. This is her registration of her birth, which was done after her parents came back to this country, but they'd named her after Florence. And this is slightly more legible. It's got her family history. And you can see that she and her sister Parthenope are down on the left. They are the daughter of William and Frances. If you look upwards, you'll see that she should have been, by rights or by convention anyway, named Florence Shaw. But the Nightingale name further up the family had died out. And so Aunt Evans, Elizabeth, in her will, had basically left money to Florence's father, so long as he changed his name to Nightingale. And he wasn't a daft man. He did exactly that. And that provided some of the wealth that's enabled Florence to do what she did. The other reason for showing this, very sensitive, the other reason for showing this is that you'll notice that Frances, her mother, was the daughter of William Smith, who was an MP of many years standing. And that, we will see, plays into Florence's life a bit later. She died some 90 years later. And just a couple of things that I'll highlight on this. One is that the death certificate is of a different format, much more like the modern death certificates that we use now. And we'll talk about that a little bit. And the other I noticed when I put this up is that if you can see the person signing off the death, it's E. Garrett Anderson. I can only imagine that's Elizabeth Garrett Anderson, who was the first female surgeon and physician. So I think that's a really nice touch. I hadn't realised that they'd had contact. But the beginning and end of her life isn't much fun. So we're going to go right back to her early education. And her father was enlightened, not just in taking money and changing his name, but unusually, he wanted to educate his daughters. And he did that himself. He'd been educated at Cambridge. And although we think of Florence as perhaps someone who specialised in maths, actually, she had studied Latin, Greek, history, philosophy, modern languages and music as well. And her sister very much preferred sketching. This is a picture from the National Portrait Gallery in 1836. So Florence in the pink was about 16, and her sister is holding her own sketchbook. Whereas Florence's Greek was good enough that later on she helped Benjamin Jowett in his translation of Plato's Dialogue. So she was clearly a very able young woman. And judging by that picture, destined for a fine life, probably as the wife of a rather rich man. But Florence didn't want to do that. And at 16, she had a mystical experience, her calling, that she wasn't destined for a conventional life. She was deeply religious, which we often brush over, but I wanted to show this window, which has been commissioned for her 200th anniversary in Romsey Abbey. Stephen Evans drew it to my attention. And I contacted Sophie Hacker, who did it, to ask permission to show it. She sent me a high quality image and made me promise that I would also say that she's about to have a book come out, which is about the imagery on it. So although you probably can't see it here in the background to places like Scutari that were very important to her, there's an owl up there, that baby owl that she saved in Athens. And apparently she was very, very keen on birds and saw herself almost as Franciscan. And that's a quotation from Isaiah, "Lo, it is I." And she answered, "Here I am, Lord, send me." Now, whatever you make of that, she went on to do good things, but that stayed as one of the cores of her life. So as a young adult, she didn't want to get married. She felt called by God. She was obviously searching for what she did want to do. And by the age of 25, she'd got it into her head that she wanted to be a nurse, and she wanted to go to Salisbury Infirmary. And she said, "It was as if I wanted to be a kitchen maid." And she drew the conclusion, not unreasonably, that only widowhood or poverty would give an educated woman a reason to work. By 1848, having not been allowed to go and do nursing, she actually went in and did some teaching at the Ragged School in Westminster. And I don't know whether it was this one that's a portrait by Blakely, but I suspect if it wasn't that one, it would be very similar. And that opened her eyes to poverty. This was not the life she'd been accustomed to, but her family did not like her doing it. They did not want her near those people. So what was she going to do? Well, a quick whistle-stop tour. Her family thought that she needed to travel. So she went to Egypt and Greece. Was she taken by the classical antiquities? Not at all. While she was in Germany, she went to a school in Kaiserswerth near Dusseldorf. It was a hospital, an orphanage and a school. And it was staffed by deaconesses, which were trained by the pastor and his wife. And she really got drawn towards that. And essentially a year later, she went back to Kaiserswerth against strong family opposition. But by now, she was 30 by this point, she wasn't taking no for an answer. But when she got back to Britain, she couldn't find an outlet for her training. So she visited hospitals throughout the UK and Europe. She collected information. She analysed and reflected on hospital reports and government publications on public health, really putting her previous training to really good use. And then eventually, and I can only imagine her family must have been relieved, she got a job with a good name, the Lady Superintendent of an Institution for Sick Gentlewomen, No. 1, Upper Harley Street, which is still where the sort of posher type of medicine takes place. But the Crimean War came along, and like so many women, when the war came along, she got going and she went out to the Crimea, which is where she earned the sobriquet, the Lady of the Lamp. Now, she did some nursing, but again, as she'd already been doing, she started thinking and analysing. And these graphs are well known among statisticians, but maybe not to some of the other of the audience. And they looked at causes of mortality among the soldiers from 1854 to 1855, and then the following year for the same cycle, and the wedges are months. And what she's got here is a wonderful graphical representation showing that although some of the soldiers were dying from battle, actually a lot more were dying from infectious diseases, which were much more preventable, and only a few were dying from other things. And after some interventions, the reason the left-hand one is so much smaller than the right-hand one is that she got those deaths right down. And if, when lockdown reopens, you come to London, the originals of those are in the Science Museum in the Winton Gallery, and they're well worth seeing because they're just lovely to look at. And on the strength of that, she was elected a fellow of the Royal Statistical Society, well, of what was then the Statistical Society of London, which was the forerunner of the Royal Statistical Society. You had to be nominated. She had nominees who included William Farr and William Guy. William Farr set up the General Register Office, and it was he who was responsible for taking the essentially way of registering births and deaths through the parishes into a national system, which is why her birth was done just sort of on what happened to be there on the church she was registered in, whereas by the end it's a national certificate that you see. And William Guy went on to be president of the Royal Society, founded the Guy Medals, which the panelists who are joining me later have got a goodly collection of between them. So she was supported by some eminent people. And a lot of people called William around at that stage, I notice in passing. So what else did she do? And she wrote a lot, which means that we know a lot about what she thought. I would call her a feminist. She wouldn't have used that word. It wasn't in currency at that time. But she was scathing about the education available to women and the limited expectations society had of their role. She was fuming. The time has come when women must do something more than domestic hearth, which means nursing the infants, keeping a pretty house, having a good dinner and an entertaining party. Well, I must say right at the moment, the idea of being allowed to meet people for a good dinner, having an entertaining party is rather nice. But for me, that would be the icing on the cake. The expectations of a woman of her time was that would be her entire life arranging that kind of thing. She said, why have women passion, intellect, moral activity, these three, and a place in society where not one of these three can be exercised? So she really saw it and articulated what was unfair about it. So I'm just coming forward to more or less the present day briefly, and then we'll go back to carry on with Florence. How are we doing now? What do these people have in common? I mean, clearly they are white men of a certain age, with the exception of this one down here. And the reason I've got the heron in there is that there was someone called David Heron I wanted to include, but I couldn't find a picture of. So the heron from my lockdown walks in St. James's Park is proudly standing surrogate. Well, if you don't recognise all of them, the clues, Royal Statistical Society, a president's board, they are all previous presidents of the Royal Statistical Society. And what they have in common, you might guess if you know even two or three of them, is that they're all called David. And wonderful presidents they've been. But if I, my three-year-old grandson likes building towers, he loves building the highest tower he can with his Lego. So if I put these chaps into a tower, there are six of them. And if I then build another tower with all the female presidents, even if I include the president-elect, Sylvia Richardson, who'll be taking over in January, there are more presidents called David than there are female presidents in our 185 years. And I think if I could have found all the pictures of the chaps called William, it would have been an even bigger tower. So my younger grandson is at the stage where if you build a tower, he rolls over the carpet until he manages to knock it down. I don't want to knock that tower down, but I would like to kind of see a few more women beating this lot. And if Florence were here with us now and she said, well, okay, that's largely the 20th century. Some of that is taking place in 21st century. What does 21st century statistics look like? I'd give you this. We've got Crystal Donnelly, who you've already met, Joan Rogers, who you're about to meet. In the upper left-hand corner, we've got a meeting held last year by several of our sections, including the Young Statistician section, celebrating women in statistics. I was lucky enough to be asked to speak at it as a fairly new president then. And in the bottom right-hand corner, just the most wonderful photograph of my friend and colleague, Jane Hutton, who's heavily involved in the AIMS, which is the African Institute of Mathematical Statistics. It's not only women, but that is just such a joyful picture. I just wanted to show it to try to rebalance. And if anyone in this audience dares to look at these photos and say, oh, I feel a bit uncomfortable in that environment, just put yourselves in the shoes of Florence and some of the women who followed in her footsteps walking into all male environment. So things are changing. But what Florence does have in common with, I think, every woman on that picture is that she was passionate about statistics. She said, statistics is the most important science in the whole world, for upon it depends the practical application of every other science and of every art. The one science essential to all political and social administration, all education, all organisation based on experience, for it only gives us the results of our experience. She really did care about statistics. But there was another facet of Florence that I've got to know as I've been reading more about her. Although she cared passionately about education, and we'll look at a bit more of that in a minute, she also cared about action. She said during the middle portion of her life, college education, acquirement of knowledge she longed for, but that was temporary. Whereas I depart from her slightly, I still think that knowledge for knowledge's sake, if I could do pure mathematics, at least some of the time I would, just for its own sake. But Florence really had no time for that. She wanted to set up an institute for training of nurses and hospital attenders, and she inspired supporters to set up the Nightingale Fund for reform of civil hospitals. She then kept well clear of it. She didn't get involved, as many women of her class would have done, in the fundraising itself. She left others to do that while she got on with campaigning for a full commission of inquiry into Crimean deaths, 16,000 from disease versus only 4,000 from battle. And she was angry about that and she wanted things done about it. So just picking up some of the other things about education, she had a keen interest in the village elementary school near a family home in Derbyshire. She wrote about education in schools in British colonies. She was passionate about education in workhouses for the poor, and you can see where her experience in Westminster stood her in good stead for that. And all the time these themes come through, it should be practical, it should be hands-on education, manual skills are prioritised. And whenever she wasn't happy about anything, education was part of the answer. She as we've seen, was very concerned about British soldiers, and she championed their education. She was a bit scathing about the army doctors. And again, she thought part of that solution was education. She'd got her followers raising money for the Nightingale School of Nursing. And when it was set up, she then became much more engaged again. And she gave detailed instructions. It should be taught by practitioners, not by people who were hands off. And there were things in there that each nurse should have her own room so that she could study quietly. And what that meant was her influence spread as graduates took senior roles and went worldwide. I gave a talk, which I talked about Florence in Australia, and found that, you know, she'd never been out there, but some of her protégés had been out there and set up the way that they were doing things there. So her influence was phenomenal. And I think those of us involved in education know that often the most important thing we do is the future generations that we train. And Alex Atwell has written a lot about her education, so I'm grateful for that. And as I said, she was passionate that education is to teach men not to know but to do. It's about observation, reflection, training. And she said every 5 or 10 years really requires a second training nowadays. Well, nothing could be truer now. I think the pace we're going at, we could all do with a second training. So who else did she think needed educating? And this is where her relationship with her grandfather comes in, because although she, as a woman, she would not have gone anywhere near Parliament, through her grandfather, who I think, if I've got it right, was an MP for best part of 4 decades, she knew that politicians didn't always get it right. And she had a correspondence going with Benjamin Jowett, who was, I think, just 3 years older than her. And this wonderful quote, which you've got to imagine it, those of you who know Sheila Bird need this read in her tone of voice. Our chief point was that the enormous amount of statistics at this moment available at their disposal or in their pigeonholes, which means not at their disposal, is almost absolutely useless. Why? Because cabinet ministers, their subordinates, the large majority of whom have received a university education, have received no education whatever on the point upon which all legislation and administration must, to be progressive and not vibratory, ultimately be based. We do not want a great arithmetical law. We want to know what we are doing in things which must be tested by results. And I just find that such a powerful image, that these highly educated politicians have facts and figures which over they knew how to use them, would help them planning the running of the country, but they just didn't know how, and so they're languishing in these pigeonholes. So what was she going to do about that? The reason she was writing to Benjamin Jowett was that she was well aware that Oxford was the place, still is for that matter, that educates a large number of our politicians. So she thought that statistics should be introduced into the studies at the University of Oxford by setting up a professorship of applied statistics. And she wanted to address the need for statistics related to education, penology, workhouses in India. This was not about mathematics and probability theory. This was for application. At the time, Oxford didn't think it was suitable. They tried to persuade her, I think, to write an essay, fund an essay prize instead, and she would have nothing to do with it. And so they missed out. I have to say that if she came to Imperial saying, I want to set up a chair for this kind of purpose, our advancement people would be leaping at her. And I'm quite sure that in Oxford now, your development teams would also be quite willing to help anybody who feels minded to fund this, because it is still needed. So what's the equivalent of pigeonholes? Because though we may still have them, they're not now our primary means of communication. And again, when I saw this image, it just summed it up for me. These days we have databases, email accounts full of attachments that we are meant to read, meant to digest, that would help us do our jobs more properly. But we either don't know how to get in there or we don't have the time. And so that to me is the modern analogue for politicians, that it's not necessarily that we're short of data, sometimes we're short of good data, but you need the wherewithal to do something useful with it. And one of the things the Royal Statistical Society has done is to publish its data manifesto. So whenever there's an election, we send our data manifesto to the candidates and try and get them to sign up to it. It's got 10 recommendations about how to improve data for policymaking, democracy and prosperity of society. And very often they sign up to say that if they're elected, they'll do some training. Some of them actually do it. And probably the most pertinent one that I think Florence would like is that politicians, policymakers, and other professionals working in public services should be given basic training in data handling, statistics, and interpreting evidence. And she was firmly of the opinion that the main end of statistics should not be to inform the government as to how many men have died, but to enable immediate steps to be taken to prevent the extension of disease and mortality. And when I used some of this material in my presidential address last year, that was more or less where I stopped. In the current climate, I think we can look a bit further. So what are we now doing? Firstly, modelling. My colleagues, Neil Ferguson, and a big team that includes Crystal, got going as soon as we identified COVID, and they put up lots of reports. Report number 9 is arguably the most influential, is most talked about, which was what would happen to cases of hospitalised cases of COVID if we did nothing. And this red line here is the surge capacity in hospitals. You can see that it would be wildly exceeded, and what would it do under various lockdown strategies. And for me, my last day in my office was actually the 16th of March on the basis of this report. Politicians spoke out. It took them a week later before we properly went into lockdown. But I listened to that message and thought, I really don't know what I'm doing coming into work. And that, of course, was 2 days before we were due to do this lecture on the 18th of March. It was cancelled, I think, the previous Friday. But I was also delighted when I saw that I wasn't delighted that new hospitals needed building, but they named them the Nightingale Hospitals. Now, I'm sure that was for the nurses, but I rather liked the idea that it was data and modelling that was informing a response. As it turned out, it wasn't needed, at least so far, as much as we thought it might be, but I think it was absolutely the right call at the time. And many of us, certainly at Oxford and at Imperial, have been collecting data ever since. The ONS in conjunction with the University of Oxford are collecting lots of data, but I'm part of the Imperial React studies, which have collected data now every month since May. And this, you can look at the different regions of the country. So up in the top left-hand corner, we can see in London where the rates weren't too high. On the axis, the top of that is 2.5%. 2% just underneath it. If I can do it without flicking the slides on, so that's 2% there. London have never gone anywhere near that, whereas the northwest next to it, and Liverpool is my second city, hit that a while ago, but with severe lockdown and other measures, they've come back down again. So this kind of data, rigorously done on random samples, is absolutely vital as one of the contributing factors to the epidemic. This data was released yesterday. These data were released yesterday, but the first version was with government last week. And what's wonderful about this is the team. I'm working with all sorts of people that I've worked alongside but never worked with properly before, including Crystal. When we said, who else do we need? Well, we knew we were going to have temporal and spatial data, so let's get Peter Diggle. It was a bit like putting together your fantasy research team. And what that means is we're doing our mapping properly. This graph shows a month ago what the rates were doing, up to about 3%. And whereas they've really got the fact there's not so much dark shows that they've gone down between round 6 and round 7. The on the other diagonal, kind of the round 6A split into 2 because there was a lot of activity in the middle of that. And because we've now done over 1 million tests in total, but because of the rates at the moment, we have enough to do it at local authority level. There are 346 of them. And that scale, if you can't read it on your machine, goes up to 4%. So there are some little pockets where the rates are heading in that direction, which is really quite worrying. But it's a level of resolution that means that the data can be used to inform actions, is the point I'm trying to make. I'm a trialist, so you'd expect me to say something about trials. There have been a lot of trials started, but the three I want to highlight are three what are called platform trials. They're the national priority clinical trials, the principal trial, which is in higher risk patients in primary care, recovery in hospital, and RENAP capping critically ill patient trials. And the thing to note is that the chief medical officers for England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland wrote to say that these are the national priority trials on the 3rd of April. I mean, if you think how long it normally takes to get trials going, the idea that we could identify a disease sometime in January and have complicated trials up and running by April and recovery started recruiting really fiercely straight away is quite phenomenal. The principal and REMAP CAP are both what are called Bayesian adaptive studies. They're built on previous work. So the point, again, I'm trying to draw out is that preparedness what matters in all sorts of ways. And the fact that there were protocols ready to go really meant that we could get motoring with this. It's not a conflict of interest, but I chair the data monitoring committee for the principal trial, which didn't recruit very much early on, but my goodness, it's galloping now. So we're suddenly having to have, you know, at least potentially weekly data monitoring committees in the diary because we're recruiting at over 150 a week. And just as a sort of snippet, REMAP CAP, which is led by my colleague Tony Gordon, has had about 3,000 patients randomised, and it's already shown that hydrocortisone steroid treatment improves recovery in critically ill patients, that lopinavir and ritonavir was ineffective and provided no additional benefit, and most recently, tocilizumab, which I can barely pronounce, which is an arthritis drug, gives it an odds ratio of 1.87 for a better outcome, and there's a 99.75 probability it's superior to no immune modulation. So when they're set up properly, we can get fast answers that are feeding back into the pandemic. Now, another area where both Imperial and Oxford are leading the pack, along with various other companies, is vaccines. When people said to me a few months ago, do you think we'll have vaccines? I said, well, as far as I knew, coronaviruses are extraordinarily difficult to get vaccines for, and I wasn't holding my breath. I'm no expert on vaccines, so I don't particularly want to get into the vaccine trials, but I did want to show this that I saw on Twitter, which was from someone called Sheridan Voisey, who's not a statistician, but he just said, proud husband moment. My wife has been the lead statistician on the Oxford vaccine trial, working 24/7 since March. The team has done in 10 months what would normally take a decade to do. Not too early for bubbly, is it? And then he, with a follow-up tweet, his wife had a name, Mervyn Merrin. Now, I don't know her, but that to me stands surrogate for all the statisticians, all the trials I've shown you. You can only imagine how hard that Imperial team were working for the modelling. If they had report 9 out by mid-March, we have heads of departments meeting at Imperial, and people started saying, well, you know, when are your departments going to go back to work? I have to say, my department have not stopped working. I have never seen so many people work so hard, such long hours. And it is truly impressive what science, and in not just statistics, but statistics is absolutely at the core of that, has done. So back to Florence. This picture, you might be wondering what it is. It's in the dark, and that is actually the House of Commons. That's Big Ben, the Elizabeth Tower over there. And it's taken from the South Bank, which is where St. Thomas's Hospital is. And it's actually, I've just been for a walk around there a couple of hours ago, but because it's near my flat. But unfortunately, I didn't realise they were showing this on Florence's birthday. So I think it was probably beamed from St. Thomas's. But I just think it's a wonderful image showing modern nursing alongside nurses of Florence's time. What I love about it isn't the nursing analogy, although clearly that's important. I just love the idea that Florence is kind of all over those politicians, looking at them and saying, okay, so are you doing what you're meant to be doing? It's a brilliant image. So what have the RSS been doing? Because we haven't got Florence to do it for us now. At our March council meeting, which was the first one we had fully online, which was rearranged at a few days' notice, unsurprisingly, we discussed COVID and what we should do. And my initial reaction was, my colleagues are doing quite enough, we don't need any kind of task force. But actually, it was very clear that we did need some coordination. And I asked Sylvia Richardson, who's the incoming president, and David Spiegelhalter, who's my predecessor, to chair it. And they brought together, again, a stunning group on design of data collection, diagnostic studies, modelling, forecasting, treatment studies, enhancement of public understanding in other areas. And if you want to know more about their work, I've left the link there. And a lot of this is actually sort of slightly unsung. They get requests when we put the React protocol together over the weekend. I thought, when, you know, this hasn't got the luxury of peer review, but we sent it to the COVID task force and they came back with stunningly good comments. So, you know, they got that study is a great deal better for their input. And I know that they're giving advice to government, and David may be able to say more about that. But when we need to be high profile, when we need to do what Florence would have us do, we do. And one of the surprising things that we hadn't foreseen came with exams. The exams for 16-year-olds and 18-year-olds got cancelled. And I then got a phone call or email from Paula Williamson, who, longstanding colleague from my Liverpool days, who happens to be married to a teacher and had a couple of lads doing A-levels, her twins. And she said, I've just seen the request for scores for what they've got to put in. And I think there are statistical issues here. What has the RSS done about it? Well, at that point, we hadn't realised there were statistical issues because it took someone on the ground to flag them up. But essentially, we wrote letters. And then when it broke in the summer, we wrote rather more firmly. And colleagues who know more about educational things than I do have played a blinder. But if they wanted to fight in the papers because Ofqual said some things that we didn't like, yeah, we can have the arguments in the headlines. And equally, I can absolutely understand why there was a will to put money into mass testing to try to sort things out. But there are well-rehearsed statistical issues underlying what is essentially screening. And John Deeks and others wrote on that, and the Times picked up on the front page. So again, Royal Statistical Society headline news. So when we need to, I hope that Florence would appreciate what we're doing. So what about Florence's legacy? Her correspondence with Benjamin Dowett continued. And he wrote her, interestingly, New Year's Eve 1879, saying there was a great deal of romantic feeling about you 23 years ago when you returned home from the Crimea. And now you're working in silence and nobody knows how many lives are saved by nursing hospital, how many thousand soldiers are now alive owing to your forethought and diligence, how many natives of India in this generation, generations to come have been preserved from famine and oppression. By the energy of a sick lady, you can scarcely rise from a bed, because what some of you will know, but I didn't mention, is that Florence, after coming back from the Crimea, had some health problem. No one's quite sure what it is, but essentially, instead of traveling the globe, she basically took to her room. So there she is, sick lady, you can scarcely rise from a bed. The world does not know all this or think about it, but I know it and often think about it. And I think it was well meant. And then I did some sums and I thought, when he wrote this, she was 59, which was the age I was when I started my presidency. It's actually just it could be read as just a little bit patronising. But anyway, roll forward, Benjamin Jowett died in 1893. Florence was still going strong in 1906. You can see her in her room. She's got her books. She's got her notebooks. And I came across this year and I thought, and I was feeling, yeah, it's the right thing to do to stay at home, but I thought, gosh, yeah, I'm meant to have been traveling. I was meant to be coming to Oxford, going to Finland, going to the States, you know, all sorts of nice things being present. I thought, how can I be a president when I'm just stuck in, you know, the desk in my bedroom? But actually, when I saw that, I thought, well, Florence did a huge amount from her room, actually did it even more effectively. And I think it gave me real courage that, you know, there's more than one way of doing what you need to do. So at that point, I haven't even asked their permission. I have co-opted presidents past, the current president and president future to wish Florence a very happy birthday and to say that the RSS and statisticians everywhere are trying to follow in her footsteps. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Deborah. That's amazing.